I'm Sam Edwards. I'm third generation cure master from S. Wallace Edwards & Sons in Surrey, Virginia. We support the Heritage Radio Network because we believe in the cause and what they're doing. They're supporting family-raised livestock, small family farms, certified humane, pasture-raised, antibiotic-free. Basically, we take the products from Heritage Foods USA and make them into Serrano-style hams, prosciutto-style hams, bacon, sausage, like my grandfather did. You can find us at SurreyFarms.com or VirginiaTraditions.com.
Welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm Linda Palacio, your host here on Heritage Radio Network. And today we are talking about presidents. This is President's Week. We had President Lincoln's birthday last week, and upcoming we have Washington's birthday coming up. And those of you with children know schools close and there's a celebration. I think it's more a ski vacation than anything else, but we call it President's Week. Ooh, there's sales in all the department stores, the President's Week sale, right? But we're talking about presidents and their preferences in foods. And we have a very special guest today, Jack Haney, who has some direct experience with that. And he worked with a lot of the White House executive chefs. Now, the White House executive chef is responsible for the planning and managing and preparing of all the menus and meals at the White House for the first family, for their private entertaining, for their day-to-day meals as well as the state dinners and fancy banquets. And we hear a lot about the state banquets and you know, fancy dinners, but not so much about the day-to-day foods and the presidential preferences. We're going to hear some of those inside stories. Jack Haney, my guest today, is a chef and a successful restaurateur and was an owner of a catering company and an author. He's written the book Secrets of the White House Kitchen. Jack has long had a hobby for collecting the likes and dislikes in food of different heads of states. And we're not talking just presidents. We're talking kings and queens, dictators, whatever. And at the age of 23, Jack became a master chef and went to the White House. The rest is history, as we will hear, and was a visiting chef. So welcome, Jack.
Thank you very much, Linda.
What is a visiting chef?
Well, even, you won't believe this, but even the government watches their payroll, especially at the White House for some reason.
I should hope so.
Yeah, it's kind of nice. It's a little refreshing. A visiting chef is a person that they can call that has a proper security clearances and so on and so forth to come in when they need whatever it may be, a chopper dicer, a sous chef, help with a state occasion or a small dinner party the president is having with friends and family, whatever the reason. And it was just a tremendous experience for me.
Oh, sounds like a great gig for somebody
23
to get.
Years of age.
Yeah.
And I was probably the most active visiting chef, and that's what they call them today. They used to call them White House wine and food consultants, a much better, nicer ta-ta name, you know.
Yeah.
But it was very interesting to meet these people and work for them.
Well, so you worked with, you served Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, Ford. Reagan, and a little bit of Bill Clinton. And this book you have, the book that Jack has written, is called Secrets from the White House Kitchens.
Ta-da.
Sounds very top confidential, top classified information there. So what are some of these secrets? I mean, when you say secrets, we're not talking secret recipes, because there were no private secret recipes necessarily.
No. And not necessarily so much the likes and dislikes of the presidents. The secrets are the anecdotes, the unwritten history.
Uh-huh.
And the book goes from FDR to Obama. And I interviewed every president from Truman on through to Clinton. I didn't get the. I was too young
too late
for FDR.
To do FDR, right?
And I was. I never got the chance to interview Obama or George W. Bush, but the history of the food is amazing. When you go through the book, you will see what FDR ate and Ike and Truman. And it was the era of the 40s and the 50s where a baked potato and a full stick of margarine was really healthy for you. And Ike loving to play canasta or bridge and having what they call TV dinners, only they weren't the frozen type TV dinners. They made them.
Would they put them in the trays?
And they'd put them on the trays and they'd watch their black and white 6-inch television set.
Uh-huh.
And then went on to the farm food, really, of Truman. And then the sophisticated, and I'll say this very politely, the sophisticated taste of Jackie Kennedy,
mm-hmm.
and what JFK really liked.
Mm.
I mean, he went for the Bourguignon and all that, but you know, he'd chase after little John, that's the most gorgeous little boy I've ever seen, and he would just chase him all over the place, playing with him, and run him through the kitchen, and he'd stop, and he'd stick his, I mean, here's the President of the United States, sticking his finger in and say, John, that's good chowder today. You know, bingo, off after John again. And it's those experiences that I treasured.
Well, that must have made for a very exciting life, I'm sure.
It did.
And you've worked, and through that, you worked with a lot of the executive chefs in the White House.
Oh, yeah.
And starting with René Verdon, we were just before the show began. René Verdon went on to be a very successful restaurateur after he left the Kennedy administration.
Yes.
And just recently passed away, and we were sorry to hear that.
86 years old. He was just a great, great chef.
Well, and you mentioned Jackie's taste for the more sophisticated. Well, René Verdon was the classic French chef.
René Verdon, in his day, was rated as the second greatest chef, living chef in the world.
And we're talking 1960,
1959, 1960.
Yeah.
And Jackie didn't offer the job to him first. She offered the job to the French chef working in the American Embassy in Paris, and he turned it down. And René was the executive chef for the Carlyle Hotel, mm-hmm. here in New York, and he took the job. The Kennedys had a big presence at the Carlyle Hotel for many years. I think they owned
it. They kept an apartment there for a long
time.
Yes, right.
And so she offered the job to René. And I went to the White House at 23 years of age to interview him and to interview the President, Mrs. Kennedy, and about the steak
dinners and all that stuff. You were doing double duty as a chef and as a journalist.
As a journalist, a so-called journalist, if you will, for the Canadian Food Journal.
Huh.
And the story never got published. They turned it down after I wrote it, but I was invited to stay, which was more important.
Mm-hmm.
And we just took an instant liking to one another, and the President and I did the same thing. And, you know, a kind word about Jackie. She never forgot her employees, ever. You know, I got stacks of Christmas cards and happy birthday cards to my kids and all of that. And it's just something I like to talk about because people look at her like she was very standoffish and so on, and she wasn't. She was very warm and
a
gracious lady.
That's good to hear. Through all these people, this book, I have to say, there are a lot of anecdotes in the book from each of those administrations that we mentioned that you worked, that you interviewed and wrote about. But the book is packed. It's mostly recipes, packed with recipes. Now,
right.
Whose recipes are these in the book?
They're both the White House and the President's family recipes. They bring their favorite recipes with them to the White House.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. And I made a collection of them. I have about 10,000 of them. And I chose these because it was, and then I simplified the form so people could really.
That's what I wanted to know. Did you tweak? Are these your tweakings of the recipes somewhat?
Slight tweakings because I didn't want to ruin. You know, I have no business changing the President's recipe,
mm-hmm.
but if it would not fit into a family or a party of six. Some of these recipes,
or the modern day
cooking
pantry.
Yeah,
right.
They're all. I shaved them all down so an average party of six people could eat. And
okay, so you said John F. Kennedy liked the plainer foods or the simpler foods. What was one of his favorite meals?
Well, you know, he loved his fish and chips, or as they say in England, he called it that too. But the chips had to be handmade. He couldn't have the frozen type, and he knew the difference. And, of course, he loved fish chowder, clam chowder, the Boston type. Chowder.
Boston boy. Yeah.
He didn't care for the Manhattan chowder at all. And he loved lobster Figaro and things like that that you you eat at the better restaurants in Boston. And then he would acquiesce to his wife and have the French food as well. Loved Rene Verdun a lot more than Lyndon Johnson did.
Well, Lyndon Johnson didn't keep him around very long.
No.
Well, now tell me about that. The executive chefs. You know, we for a long time, people didn't hear a whole lot about who the executive chef is. Now the name is coming up in the press more often.
Sure.
About the hiring and firing of the executive chefs, because sometimes we hear that a chef will go from a Republican president to a Democratic president and then continue. So it's not like it changes right with the administration.
Well, the chefs, although they have a very unique job, they are still considered house staff. And they're appointed and usually hired by the first lady.
Mm.
And you go through the interviews and so on, unless you're really well known, like a Paul Bocuse or somebody like that. You didn't have to do that with a guest chef so much. They would call the French embassy, they'd call Jack in Buffalo, New York, or whoever they could get to come in. But they would stay. Roland Mizenay stayed there for 30 years.
Wow.
And, of course, he was the greatest pastry chef I think the culinary world has ever known.
Well, now, this is something interesting that I think a lot of our listeners aren't aware. I just learned it as well. And that is that the executive pastry chef is a completely separate entity from
totally isolated
executive chef. I mean, they confer with one another about what's being served
about
for dinner
and so on.
But the executive chef does not have any control over the pastry chef. Right?
No. And with Roland Mizenay, it was his imagination and his artistic flavor. The man was an absolute genius.
He set the form for many of the pastries that
we eat
today.
You know, another thing is, the one who really set the form in the for the presidency, of course, was George Washington with the protocols. And everything in those days was French. And the treaties were written in French, and the diplomatic protocols were French. And the food they served was as French as they could get. And then when Jefferson came
really... Well, first of all, George Washington did not live in the White House.
No.
John Adams was the first to live in the White House.
He was the
first
guy.
And it wasn't even finished, right?
And it wasn't even finished. You know, the White House is never finished. It's always under construction somewhere. But then for a lot of years, they were just serving American food, not any of the French food. And that things changed when Jackie came in. And she went back to that French protocol and skipped the white tie dinners and made them a little more informal. Instead of a 25-course menu, you know, it's a 5 or 7-course menu, a little of this, a little of that. If you ever spend any time in France, that's how they serve.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a great idea. And people, of course, clamored for an invitation to the White House. And they still do.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and
well, are these, what I wanted to know when we were talking about the recipes, are these recipes kept in the Library of Congress, or they passed around? I mean, how did
some
you
are,
get a hold
I got
of
them, them? I got them with permission to use the White House Library.
Ah,
and okay. In the book, if it just mentions the recipe in the title, that's a family recipe. If it says White House or a la White House, then that's an official White House recipe.
Okay.
And in some cases, the recipe repeats itself in the book.
Yeah,
and
I did notice that. We're going to save one of those dishes for the second part of the show.
Okay, because that was done on purpose. It served one president, then it served another one.
But a little different.
A little different.
Right. What I would like to do is you start out with FDR, and so I would like to go back to that point and start with him. So we can take a little break first, and when we come back from our break, we're going to talk about Eleanor Roosevelt's influence on the White House kitchen.
All right.
The following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Every Sunday at 3:30 p.m., tune in to We Dig Plants with garden designers Carmen DeVito and Alice Marcus Krieg of Groundworks, Inc. The girls delve into our human relationship with plants as food, medicine, fodder, and a source of beauty and inspiration. They bring the culture to horticulture and discuss such topics as botany how-to, cultivation, horticultural history, garden design trends, and all things generally budding. Again, that's every Sunday at 3:30 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network.
Welcome back. We're talking with Jack Hanney, the author of Secrets from the White House Kitchens. And Jack was a visiting chef at the White House for many years, for those of you who might not have heard the first part of the show. And Jack, I wanted to talk about the first president that you mentioned in your book, FDR, and of course, his wife, Eleanor, as we know, was a very strong woman. Tell me a little bit about the food in the during the FDR presidencies. Well, oh, and that was a long term.
You and I were babies, or before. You know, I think we came along after that. But the one thing that comes to mind, Franklin Roosevelt had a woman cook in the White House, and in those days and before. Except for Chef Honoré, who worked for Jefferson, they didn't really have great chefs in the White House. I mean, the food was served, even at the state dinners, it was just, you know, a lot of food, a lot of dishes and so on, but nothing spectacular.
Well, culinarily, America was very young, is still very young.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And this woman, I can't remember her name, it's my age is creeping up on me.
The one who ended up staying longest
yes.
time? Nesbitt, Henrietta Nesbitt?
Henry, that's it. And he said, I quote FDR, "I am running for a fourth term." He told this to Churchill. "I am running for a fourth term just so I could fire that damn woman."
Well, we have to, in fairness to our listeners, we have to give a little backstory there, because Eleanor Roosevelt, we're not sure why she chose Henrietta Nesbitt, whether it was revenge on her husband. Story goes that she was running an austerity campaign. I mean, it was the Great Depression, and she wanted to show all Americans how to live frugally. And
she did.
And she did, right?
She did. But no butter at the White House.
And she hired this woman who was not even a cook. She was a housekeeper.
Housekeeper.
Right.
And nasty. And just did not like the president. If you could imagine not liking FDR. And here the poor guy's in a wheelchair. You know, he loved food, and he loved good food.
Well, he grew up in the Hudson Valley, and anyone from the New York area knows the Hudson Valley was filled with farms and fresh food.
And why not use that.
Right.
Oh, she used to feed him the same thing every day.
Well, you were very kind to her and to them in your book, because you don't have any of the and so on and so on toast.
No.
Your recipes are actually, seem quite palatable.
You know, the Ketigree and the New Brunswick stews and... There's one in there that he loved, and I put it in. That was Martha Washington's crab soup.
Uh-huh.
And I was saving that for another book. But
that's one that got a lot of response, too.
It did.
People like that a lot.
It did.
Yeah. Well, Henrietta Nesbitt, being, as you've mentioned, a very plain cook. Oh. Well, first of all, they could have had a very successful kitchen had they stuck with more of the science and nutrition that Cornell was developing these great recipes for the kitchen, right?
Right, that's correct.
Yeah, the austerity campaign.
At the hotel school and the egg school.
Right.
Or home economics school, I'm sorry. but in those days, people, including the president and everybody, ate what was put in front of them. You know, there's poor kids in Europe right now. They're not getting any food, and you're wasting it and all that. Your mother drive you nuts and so on and so forth. And our culture over here learned to eat a different way than they do in Europe. That's for sure. And that included the White House. And then, of course, history changes.
All right. Well, as I say, you were very kind to poor Mrs. Nesbitt, and I don't know how much it was just her inability to cook or not caring, but they said one comment. A friend of mine, Laura Shapiro, wrote an article in
and
the
I
New
have
Yorker.
That article.
You have that
oh,
article,
it's great.
A scathing article on the kitchen. It was well known at that time that if one were going to a White House function during Franklin Delano Roosevelt's,
it was drudgery.
Well, to eat first before you go, because you will for sure come out hungry, right?
Oh yeah.
And the comment, I'm looking for a comment that I saw that the meals were just so gray, so dour, so flat,
nothing,
so boring.
Right, and no presentation whatsoever. Just a steak, no au jus with it or a little butter on it or whatever. It's just plunked down on a plate.
Well, and that
and
went
it was
on.
Cooked well done.
Yeah.
Yeah, right through.
Gray, as I said,
oh, yeah.
And that went on for 12 years. So though in that respect, without even anything, you know, no famous White House chef, her meals became legend. But it's
well,
nice.
Especially the one that she did with for the King and Queen of England.
Oh, tell me about that.
Oh, that was at their home in the Hudson Valley. It was potato salad, macaroni salad. It was a picnic. Hot dogs and hamburgers. And Queen Elizabeth, the Queen's mother, bit into a hot dog for the first time with mustard on it, and it shot all over the front.
We've all done that. Come
I
on.
Know, but not with a Tyra.
Oh, that's too much. Well, listen, they got a taste of America,
oh,
for
they
sure.
They certainly did. You know, actually, it wasn't her ignorance of food. It was she wanted to show them what we eat here.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Germany
eats hot dogs, which I didn't think was a very good thing diplomatically do that during the war, but she did it anyway.
Well, then you go on to Truman. Anything, and what was one of the more unusual or something that stands out about Truman's likes or dislikes?
Well, I met Harry Truman in Buffalo, New York. He gave a speech at Canisius College, and I got a chance to interview him. And what he said to me was something I hope it was just for me that I wrote down. It's probably one of the funniest anecdotes I've ever heard in my life. And he was a crusty old guy. He was out of office at the time. And I was lucky enough to be invited to the stag dinner after this affair or after his speech. And his tastes were very simple. He was a farmer. He tried going into business and as a haberdasher and went bankrupt. He had a partner, and they just went, as we call today, belly up. And he became a politician, a magistrate, and so on. But he had very common tastes, hamburger soup, and so on. And if you notice when you go through, you see that. I think I mentioned this before. And then it stopped, and you got very sophisticated. And then all of a sudden, Ronald Reagan came in as the oldest president ever elected, and hamburger soup was one of his favorites. But he would accept the modern-day executive chef French-style cooking as well. The recipes in his chapter, I think, are really great.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, as I looked through the book and read some of the anecdotes, I realized that most of the, at least I would assume they were family meals, most of the family meals were, they were, by and large, pretty simple simple tastes. I mean, nothing very extravagant, right?
They're Americans. They're you and I.
Yeah, and besides hamburger soup, there was another dish that made an appearance more than once in the book, and that was Ronald Reagan's favorite dish, the macaroni and cheese.
Oh, mac and cheese. And mac and cheese, ever since it was invented, has been a rage in this country. And you know, every mother made mac and cheese, and they had their special way of doing it, and some people would add tomatoes to it, and some people would add just Velveeta cheese to it, and so on. But everybody has a different recipe for it. And you know, to this day, I love mac and cheese.
What's not to like about
it,
right?
Yeah, try to get that in Paris.
That's right. Well, food has all, you know, there were presidents and food, there have been different little anecdotes associated with most all presidents or their wives, you know, throughout history. Is there, Andrew, I'm thinking of James Madison, because his wife Dolly recognized Sally Shad's frozen concoction.
2 miles away from my home.
2 miles
away. Is Montpelier,
away. Yes. Ah, and Sally Shad was a freed slave who was a chef, and she invented this frozen concoction, and Dolly Madison proclaimed it fantastic ice cream, and it shall be served at all the state dinners, right? Andrew Jackson. Now, and I'm going to compare him to someone that you worked with. Andrew Jackson was well known for having some big dinner or event where he brought in this huge round of cheese that weighed almost a ton.
Well, it was given to him. It did weigh a ton. It was a cheddar cheese, and it was brought in by, it was a new Democratic Party at the time, and they were really celebrating. They tore up the White House. Mm. I mean, in those days, you could just walk in and out anytime you wanted. Need to see the president? Oh, he's right over there in his office. Try that today. It's right. You know, it's a different world we live in. But, yeah, the cheese weighed 2,000 pounds, one ton.
And story goes that the White House smelled like cheddar cheese for a year later, right?
And but old Andy allowed it, and they cut into it, and everybody ate and drank and
got rowdy,
And got rowdy.
Well, that reminded me of something that another president did, and that's Ronald Reagan. Had, for his inauguration, they brought in, again, we're talking tons, another ton of jelly beans.
Jelly bellies. The little jelly bellies. He put Jelly Belly and Tom Clancy right on the map. And, Mr. President, you know, what's with the jelly beans? Well.
Good.
Thank you. He would, if he offered you jelly beans, you know, most people would take a handful. Oh, no, he'd say, one at a time, because each one had a different flavor. I mean, he was a gourmet of jelly beans, the maven, and he used to tell people that, and he had a jar of them sitting on his desk, so everybody else in the White House had to have a jar sitting on the desk, because he had a habit of walking into the offices unannounced. And I think it was a sugar high that kept him going at his age.
Whatever it takes.
Whatever it takes. Yeah, he became a legend.
What's the most memorable dinner that you ever assisted in, be it the largest or most unusual?
Shortly after the King of Greece abdicated and the new government took over. And his sister, Princess Irene, and Queen Frederica, his mother, were visiting the White House. And their menu, Pompano, and then the other one was, it wasn't a state dinner. It wasn't a state luncheon, but it was a formal luncheon. And lamb chops and so on. And then the Prime Minister of Canada, Lester Pearson, mm-hmm. and Emperor Haile Selassie.
Oh.
I can't ever forget Emperor Haile Selassie. Right. You know, I had met him 2 times before, both at the Kennedy funeral. He came in for the Kennedy funeral. He was a great friend of America's, and he was put up at Blair House. And one of the odd things was he used to love to get up in the middle of the night and eat. So we couldn't allow that to happen, so we set up a buffet. And it was a man buffet. When he got up, he had his choice, and then every couple hours we changed the food.
24/7?
And it was 24/7 till he went back, yeah.
Wow. Well, that was another question I had, and that is White House kitchens. There are more than one. How many kitchens?
There's three.
Three White House kitchens. Are they open, or is one of them open 24/7?
The White House mess is.
Mm.
It's an awful name to call a very fine restaurant, by the way. It's run by the Navy, as it has been for years and years and years. And they have their own chef. It's excellent. Then there's the main kitchen, and which is used for larger events and so on. And then there's the smaller kitchen, which is in the residence. And of course, the pastry chef had his own kitchen. Hmm. So there's actually four.
So if a meeting or work is going on all night long and someone should get hungry and want the proverbial ham sandwich that was in some movie, that
they go right into the White House mess.
Huh. And they can get what they want.
And they
just call
what they want. And the food is fabulous.
I'll bet. Got to keep those.
Machines
going.
The truth behind the Navy is they've always ate well.
Hmm.
You know.
Oh, that's that. And then that is he's the commander in chief, the president. So there you go.
He deserves the very best for four years.
Well, what I failed to mention your restaurant and the family business, which is one of the oldest restaurants in America. And it's called, just as we close out here, it's called the Eagle House.
My beloved Eagle House.
In Buffalo.
It's actually in Williamsville, which is a suburb
of Buffalo.
And it's 184 years old. It was introduced to the area in 1827, and it's been a hotel and a restaurant ever since. It has hotel license number 1 in the state and liquor license number 2 in the state.
Liquor license number 2 imagine? In New York State.
Well, wow. Luchow's has number 1 here in New York.
Ah.
And, of course, those are prohibition licenses that were given to the 10 best restaurateurs that followed the rules and regulations of prohibition, and we're offered these licenses, and they're actually licenses that can be handed down as long as who you're handing it down to passes muster, but it'd be the same number.
Yeah.
I could pass it down to my son, he could pass it down
and
to my
And that
grandson.
Actually grandfathering in a liquor license is still something that occurs.
Sure.
Well, before we leave, I want to let our listeners know that they can get an autographed copy of your book at your website called Secrets from the
WhiteHouseKitchens.com.
There you go. Well, Jack, it has been a real treasure. I wish
Linda,
we could talk longer because I'm sure there are some interesting stories
lurking back there. It was
worth
the trip coming up here, believe me.
Great. Well, I urge people to, if you want to find out more about some of these interesting stories, to take a look at the book.
We'll do a cook-off some night.
Okay.
All right.
And check back again for more culinary history at A Taste of the Past.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. The following is a public service announcement from the Museum of Food and Drink. Dave Arnold and Patrick Martins have gathered a team of New York's most innovative chefs and bartenders to create a 9-course fundraiser lunch at Del Posto, Sunday, March 27th. Their intent? To kickstart the greatest food museum in the world. The menu for this unprecedented event is derived from educational themes of the museum. Chefs will draw inspiration from sources outside their normal sphere. How will a cutting-edge chef handle the Paleolithic, or a dish only using pre-Columbian ingredients? What will a modern Italian chef do with ancient Rome? The chefs include David Chang of Omofuku, Wiley Dufresne of WD-50, Mark Ladner of Del Posto, Nils Noren of the French Culinary Institute, Cesare Casella of Salumeria Rossi, Carlo Maracci of Roberta's, Brooks Headley of Del Posto, and Christina Tozzi of Momofuku Milk Bar. Bartenders include Audrey Sanders of Pegu Club, Thomas Waugh of Death & Company, Simon Ford of Pernod Ricard, Damon Bolte of Prime Meats, and Eben Clem of BR Guest Restaurants. Proceeds from the event will directly support the Museum of Food and Drink. Tickets are very limited and $250 per person. To purchase tickets, please visit mofad.eventbrite.com. That's mofad.eventbrite.com. Once again, mofad.eventbrite.com. Sponsored by Pernod Ricard, Heritage Foods USA, Pat LaFrieda Meats, Barterhouse Wines, Del Posto Restaurant.